The Iranians are not going to give up control of the Strait of Hormuz. What they might do, what they conceivably might do in a negotiation, is that they might agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz if they have cast iron guarantees that there will be no resumption of an attack upon themselves. I could see a conceivable situation where the Iranians might do that, because they would want to resume their own oil exports and they would want to do those things. But short of that, obviously, they are not going to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, because it is, as you absolutely rightly said, their big strategic, gives them what gives them their big strategic advantage. And clearly, it's not as straightforward an operation to reopen them as General Keane is saying.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, if that is conceivable, if it is theoretically possible, it is something that you can see, yeah, if we can get the people to agree into this, meaning the United States and Iran particularly, there is a path to where you could come to that negotiation. But then there's that sticky thing in there about the Israelis, who would have historically, so far in this war, anytime there's been any look that President Trump is thinking about some kind of negotiations, they throw some kind of monkey wrench into, because that's the last thing they want, is to have a situation to where the Iranian regime that existed prior to the war under Ayatollah Khamenei, now led by Mujtaba Khamenei as the supreme leader, to leave that in power, to leave it in a stronger position with less sanctions on it, and still have effective control over that Strait of Hormuz, and now some sort of guarantees. We'll see, you know, who knows how that would be working out. But if that ended the war, that's something that Israel wouldn't like, because that would literally leave Iran in a stronger position than it was prior to the war, which is entirely predictable. But this irrational thinking is where we are in this point right here. Now, let me ask you one specific question that you were mentioning here a second ago about the Europeans. And I wonder if you could briefly explain to us a little bit, what is the British? Because if there's anybody historically the best naval power in Europe, and that's going to be the UK, where are they with this? Because this started with before the war started with Keir Starmer saying you cannot use RAF Fairford or British bases to have a war against Iran, because we don't think that's a good idea. It's not even legal, etc. And then that shifted a little bit. But where is it now? So I wonder if you could just kind of walk us through where the UK was prior to the war, where they have shifted, and where are they now, especially on this issue of sending British warships or military folks to either take part in a ground offensive or to open the strait?
I think the British government has found itself in a very, very difficult position. I mean, they should have been very forthright before the conflict began. They should have come up to Washington. They should have said, look, this is, we're hearing these reports that this is what's being planned. We don't think this is a good idea at all. We are extremely vulnerable to disruption in oil markets. We are particularly vulnerable in that regard. If this is indeed being planned, we want to know what that plan is. And we want to know what you're going to do if the Strait of Hormuz is closed. And unfortunately, there is no evidence that the British ever did anything like that. And instead, we got these very difficult conversations between the president and the prime minister, in which the president pressed the prime minister for the British to become involved. And of course, the British don't want to seem to say no, because we are so deeply dependent for so many things on the United States nowadays. And it is always a very uncomfortable position for any British government to say no to the President of the United States. But the realities are that there is very little practically we can do. Now, once upon a time, the Royal Navy spanned the world. It was the most powerful navy in the world. Those days are long gone. We do have some formidable ships. We have extremely well-trained crews. We have some nuclear submarines, none of which is particularly useful for a conflict in the Strait of Hormuz. The Royal Navy is not designed for this conflict. We don't have minesweepers, apparently. that would be useful in clearing mines if any mines were deployed in the Strait of Hormuz. And that is a serious worry. And if we're talking about air defense capabilities and carriers, well, we cannot add much realistically to what the Americans already have. Our fleet is relatively small. And beyond that, any such naval deployment by the Royal Navy to the Persian Gulf to involve itself in this conflict would be bitterly and fiercely opposed by many, many people in Britain. So a government that did that would trigger a political crisis over and above and on top of all of the other crises that we already have here. So I don't think it's going to happen. And I think that the same calculation is being made by governments all across Europe. Germany has said this is not our war. President Macron, France actually has a bigger navy at the present time than Britain does. But the French have come and they've sort of given some indications that they might be involved. But then President Macron says that we're only prepared to do it when the fighting ends, which basically defeats the point. So nobody in Europe is going to do very much. They don't want to say no, but that's ultimately
that's what they're saying.
They're in. That's what they're saying.
Which then makes the claim that 30 nations have signed up to help, none of which he cited, by the way, General Keane in that last soundbite. So that's kind of a tell of its own. Well, if we can't force an open to the Strait of Hormuz with naval power, then maybe some are suggesting maybe we can do it on the ground. So apparently there was number one, as we've been talking about here before, and I'm sure you've been talking about it on your show, the Duran and your own YouTube channel, is that there has been a brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division, two Marine Expeditionary Units, the 31st and the 11th, have one has basically arrived. Another one is still maybe a couple of weeks away, and a bunch of Delta Force / Special Operations Forces ground troops. We've had A-10 ground support fighter jets, and then also Apache gunships that are also for ground. So a lot of ground power is moving in there. Well, yesterday on Capitol Hill here, there was administration officials that briefed select members of Congress about what their next plan might be. And it left a lot of them pretty unhappy, even including some in the president's own party, like Nancy Mace.
Was it the information that you were receiving or the lack of information that you were receiving?
Was it
a distinction?
I would say that it's both. And I would say that you saw Republicans across the spectrum today express their frustration. You saw Republicans and Democrats alike. I was not convinced when I walked out of there that troops on the ground were necessary to declare victory. But I have a hard time understanding what Karg Island has to do with some of our objectives.
And I'm just getting some news here that the Axios is reporting that the Pentagon prepares for a massive final blow of Iran war. While President Trump is talking about maybe peace with his mouth, apparently with his fist, he's preparing for something else. And you saw Nancy Mace's response there. You can pretty well read between the lines what was told there. What do you think may be coming on the ground? And what is this make any sense at all?
Well, to me, again, this is not an area that, I mean, I haven't got a background in this area, but I cannot see what sense it makes. I don't understand what capturing Karg Island, which I accept the US military can do, but I don't understand how that changes the overall situation. There's been talk about various islands in the Strait of Hormuz, which are also claimed by the UAE, by the way. I accept, again, the US military can capture those islands. But how does that ultimately change the overall picture? The Iranians could still plant mines in the sea. They could still create disruption that way. They could still use drones. They could still use missiles. I've had experience with shipping. I cannot imagine that shippers or insurance companies will be happy sending their ships into what would remain, in fact, become an even more intensified war zone. And, well, you're showing pictures there of Kharg Island. It's far from the Strait of Hormuz. It's quite close to the Iranian coastline. I'm told that it is within range of Iranian land-based artillery. It would be enormously, it would be very risky for US troops that were deployed there, unless, of course, the shoreline were captured, which would mean sending troops into the Iranian mainland, which is a whole new set of problems. And I read a rather troubling article, I think it was in the Financial Times, which said that one of the real risks of this is that if you do capture Kharg Island, or you do capture some of these other islands, the entire strategy of the US military is going to be focused on protecting the troops trying to hold on to these islands, which will mean that there will be less energy, less a diversion, if you like, of military power from offensive tasks in Iran itself. It will become more a defensive struggle to try to protect these islands. I repeat again, this is not my background. I don't know whether that is a valid criticism, but to me, at least, it made a kind of sense. So I just don't see how this solves any of the underlying problems. You don't want a couple of islands which you might have to protect and which you would need to protect at enormous cost. You need peace with Iran. That is the objective that people should be focusing on at this time.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, aside from that, not, and I can absolutely confirm that that small number of troops, all those troops are, just for people's awareness, with the so-called elite 82nd Airborne Division and the Marines, they are somebody that can handle a pinpoint target. They can seize an airfield if they have enough of them. They can make an insertion quick, and they can get somewhere very fast. But the only as an opening round to something. You can't sustain. They're not troops that are designed to sustain anything. They can only get somewhere quick. They can do something that takes people by surprise. They can seize different assets and so, but then they have to be reinforced really quickly, or because of their lightness, they can be counterattacked and destroyed. So I don't even understand what the hope is, because so far, anyway, I haven't seen any other heavier forces also deploying that they would be the opening gambit for. Where is the staying power? I haven't even seen that apply or arrive in the region yet. So I can confirm that your understanding is correct, that they will not be able to accomplish anything militarily. And then you have the issue, the bigger issue of that would, even if you somehow magically did get a success there and held an island and caused some financial problems, that does nothing to the control of the government, does nothing about the missile program. It does nothing about the alleged kilograms of reprocessed nuclear material. So you get none of those things solved, and you don't get the strait open. Other than that, it seems like a grand idea.
Well, indeed. I mean, I would just add something else, which is that, of course, Iran had a long war with Iraq in the 1980s. It lost territory during that war. I mean, it lost territory in important places. That didn't cause Iran to capitulate. On the contrary, what it did was it motivated them to fight even more in order to gain their country back. So, I mean, seizing Kharg Island, I don't see that it solves any problem. I could see, on the contrary, how it could make things a lot worse.
A lot worse. It would. That's just kind of the situation in the Gulf. I want to turn in the remainder of the time we have to seeing what things look like from the Russian side, because Russia and China and Iran are all part of BRICS. Number one, Russia gets has a relationship with Iran that helps them in their own war with drone components and possibly some other things as well. And that's been kind of a two-way street. And certainly China has issues of interest with the Iranian the Iranian oil, which they want to see continue to come to them without interruption, et cetera. The reports have been that China has been providing some intelligence and also targeting and satellite imagery. And the Russians apparently, reports just out in the last 24 hours, apparently they're helping with other kinds of technology in addition to any kind of intelligence support. Well, President Putin actually addressed this for one of the first times I saw yesterday, and he had some interesting comments.
There are some estimates that you can compare this situation with the coronavirus pandemic that impeded the development of all the regions of all the continents. That's why they compare it with this pandemic, because the events that the global community is faced with recently shows that these heavy blows to the investment, to the international relations, to the foreign affairs, these heavy blows are happening more and more often. They are becoming a new reality, and they become a backdrop for the global economy of its transition to a new state. And to be up to this challenge, what do we need to do? We need to be strong. And we keep on saying this over and over again. And we need to be united in understanding what national interests are.
So what is the subtext there? I mean, when he says we need to be strong and we need to be united, what does that mean for Russia in relation to this this conflict in the Middle East?
Well, I think there's two things to say, and they are both there in that speech that Putin just gave. Now, the Russians, Russia is a country that is very, very focused on security. And security means that the preferred situation for the Russians in any global situation is one of stability. I know there's a narrative out there that the Russians like this war because it's pushed up oil prices, and that's going to make them an awful lot of money. And of course it is, and they will take advantage of that. But that does not mean that they want the war to continue indefinitely. For them, that is dangerous. It is unpredictable. It could create all kinds of problems in the future. If Iran comes out successful, then that might make Iran very powerful, or at least in its own perception, very powerful. The Russians have always found the Iranians very difficult people to work with, by the way. So that might make them even more difficult to work with in the future. They do not want the Iranians to be in that position. They do not want the Iranians getting into trouble. They do not want Iran collapsing, because they do not want a collapse in Iran close to the southern regions of their own country. And in terms of oil and the situation with oil, yes, of course, in the short term, the oil price rises. But if it goes up to, say, $200 a barrel and precipitates a global recession, that itself creates instability. And it could also lead to an oil price crash, which comes with a whole further set of problems. So what the preferred Russian policy would be some kind of negotiated outcome that restores stability. In the meantime, what the Russians have to do, at least this is what they're saying to themselves, is they say the world is becoming more unstable all the time. We already have our problems with the Europeans and the Americans and the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. We see this crisis in the Middle East. We have to strengthen our own positions domestically. We can't afford to show any sign of indiscipline or weakness even. And we have to be focused particularly on ensuring stability at home. It is even more important now, given that there is no stability abroad.
And that's an interesting set of, I guess, complicated in chances, because on the one hand, Russia would certainly seem to benefit from higher oil prices, because now then they're getting a lot more money for their resource. They've had sanctions partially reduced on them by the United States so that they can produce more oil and ship it out. So that's certainly helpful. But the global instability, I guess it's there's like a narrow band in there to where they're like, okay, I'm all right with this part here. But outside of that, there's other problems caused. That's an interesting, I had not considered those additional things from the Russian side. Well, that's not all that we heard from Russia today. Also, Putin's special envoy Dmitriev had this to say about the conflict.
видим, что наступает самый мощный энергетический кризис за всю историю человечества. К нему абсолютно не подготовлена ни Европа, ни Британия. Мало того, они сами выстрелили себе в ногу, отказавшись от российских энергоносителей. И поэтому наш прогноз очень простой, что фактически наступит сейчас мощнейшая деиндустриализация в Европе, мощнейшие проблемы Британии. И все это связано просто с ошибочными решениями британских, европейских политиков по энергетике. И очень важно, чтобы мы эту тему поднимали, потому что когда там не будет, соответственно, бензина на заправках, когда не будет работы, люди в Европе, в Британии должны понимать, что это вот в результате этих ошибочных решений, абсолютно четких, понятных, Урсулы фон дер Лайен и других русофобских, европейских и британских политиков.
So, I mean, just you have a point there. I mean, and let's look at it from two aspects, first of all, because there is already an ongoing issue between many in the European Union and the cutoff of Russian oil and gas, which the European Union wanted to do nice and easy and schedule it out then to 2027. But Russia's saying, you know what, maybe we'll just turn that tap off right away. So that's already been an issue. That's a problem for Hungary because they don't want it, and they're actually aggravated it. Ukraine itself for potentially blocking the path for them to get it. So that's an issue. But now that on top of that, you want to weave on there these really high prices for both oil and gas. How is that going to affect the economies in Europe on top of these other problems?
Right. It's going to create massive problems for the European economies. I mean, we are already, as Dimitri has said, in a process of deindustrialization. The most vulnerable country, as he correctly identified amongst the big countries in Europe, is actually Britain, where we have very, very low fuel reserves indeed. So we could, and we already have very, very high energy prices, twice as high as France. So we are particularly vulnerable, but everybody is vulnerable. Now, listening to Dmitriev, we need to understand that Dmitriev is somebody that we might be seeing quite a lot of over the next few months, especially if the problems in the global economy grow. Because based on following on from what Putin was saying, I highlighted Russian concerns for stability. And this is why Putin talks about Russia needing to be, especially at this time, needing to be strong. But there is the other side, which is that for the Russians, this is an opportunity. They produce oil. They produce gas. They produce fertilizer. They produce tungsten. They produce naphtha. They produce fertilizer. They produce all of these things that are now going to be in critically short supply. Who is the front man in discussing all of these things? Obviously, the person who is the head of Russia's direct investment fund, the person who is involved in agreeing financial, trade and economic contacts with the rest of the world, who is, of course, Kirill Dmitriev. So when Dmitriev speaks in this way, and talks about all of these enormous problems that the Europeans are going to be facing, he does so knowing that the Russians are going to be in a very strong position of advantage in a few months. And he's being positioned to say, look, you are where you are. Your factories are closing. You're facing power blackouts. You have no option but to come to us because we are, in practical terms, the only people who can help you in this situation. So if you do come to us, obviously we want something in return. We want all these sanctions that you've been imposing on us. We want those taken away. We will probably want other concessions as well, because of course, after all that's happened over the last 5 years, there is a deficit, a massive deficit of trust between us and you. So what Dmitriev is doing is he is laying the groundwork, and he's doing this perfectly well aware of what he's doing, by the way. And he's clearly, this is clearly flows from discussions that are taking place in Moscow. He's laying the groundwork for further negotiations, which are to come, at which he will be center stage. And they won't just be negotiations with the Americans, they will be negotiations with the Europeans too. At least that is what the Russians at this time think.
And really, I guess you can say fortunately slash unfortunately, this tremendous opportunity is just fallen into the Russians' lap because of this very foolish war of choice that we have started in the Middle East. Not only do we give leverage to Iran that they never had before, especially with control over the strait, we've also handed a lot of advantages and now new assets and capabilities to the Russian side. Is that how you see it?
Well, that's exactly right. And the Russians know about that. And they're going to use it. I mean, they're going to exploit it. And they know how. They've done this in the past. They know how to take advantage of these sort of situations. But that doesn't mean that in the long term, they want to be indefinite spoilers, that they want an endless prolongation of the war. Because that then brings us back to the other concerns that the Russians have about
instability
and stability, which are always there in the background.
And so let me ask you here in the last few minutes we have, how is Ukraine viewing all this? How is Zelensky? Because if this is an unexpected windfall in the lap of Putin and a help to the Iranian side, it is definitely a bad thing for the Ukrainian side. How are they viewing things, especially as we're just about out of the muddy season and it could open up into a spring potential offensive on the Russian side?
Well, he's very, very depressed and very, very worried about it. And if you track his statements recently, you could see this. He went on a tour of Europe trying to drum up more support from the Europeans. He's at the moment still holding out for this 90 billion euro loan, which he absolutely needs because financial pressures in Ukraine are increasing. And for the moment, that's not coming through. And he's the weapons flow from the West is dwindling. The Germans are saying that they can't buy air defense missiles from the United States at the moment because they're all needed in the Middle East. So that's leaving Zelensky and Ukraine more exposed in the sky. And as you absolutely rightly say, in 2, 3, 4 weeks' time, we will be into the spring period. The ground will harden. The movement of forces will resume. And Ukraine has never looked more vulnerable. So he's very worried about this, but not so worried that for the moment, he shows any willingness to make concessions in the negotiations. And he's complaining again about how the Americans are putting pressure on him to get Ukrainian troops out of Donbass. And again, that's something that he's not prepared to do. And I don't think he ever will do, because, again, he understands that his own political position in Kiev would not survive if he did it. And that is his immediate priority.
That is really unfortunate to hear from the perspective of the Ukrainian people, especially the men who are doing the fighting, because it's a futile operation that they continue to resist, continue to die, even if it's smaller numbers here in the last couple of months. But that's likely to increase when the weather gets better and towards the same event, which is either a military defeat or a negotiated capitulation. I don't see anything else in the cards. Do you?
No, I don't. But I think the Ukrainians also need to say to themselves that they're very, very lucky in one important respect, that they are not dealing with an unreasonable adversary. I mean, the Russians have shown continuously throughout this war and during the decade that preceded it that they are prepared to negotiate. And they do make demands, and yes, they are difficult demands for the Ukrainians. But up to now, they have not been so severe that they in themselves would place in jeopardy the continued existence of Ukraine as a state and as a nation. So the Ukrainians do have a way out. They can negotiate. They can, I think perhaps they should negotiate directly with the Russians. This is my own personal view, but you know, if not, they can use the Americans as intermediaries. They can do whatever they wish. But they do need to start accepting that this policy of refusing any concessions at all, saying all the time that we're in the right and the Russians are in the wrong and that we are the victims of aggression and we shouldn't be made to pay the price, that is politically unsustainable, and they should work to achieve terms whilst they are still able. Because if there's a Russian breakthrough this summer, well, of course, the calculus in Moscow changes.
Yes, it does. Well, for the sake of the people that are suffering from this war, I certainly hope that diplomatic way is found out so we don't have to have a military conclusion here, because that would be a lot uglier in every way for the Ukrainian side. Thank you so much for coming on today, Alexander, and giving us some clarity on really all of these things here. And we certainly recommend your YouTube page to people who just can't get enough of you. And that's most of our audience here. Just go to Alexander Mercurius on YouTube. Just Google that and you will find these great shows like we're showing on the screen right now. So appreciate you and what you do. And we look forward to having you back real soon.
Thank you very much, Daniel, and let's have you on our program too.
I'd love to be there. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. And we appreciate you guys too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't. And also, we're going to take a look with a former Commodore, Steve Jeremy, on this afternoon, from the former combat vet, of a naval combat vet, is going to talk to us about, you know, what are some of the military either capabilities or limitations in using naval power to open up the Strait of Hormuz. People talk about that a lot. We're going to get it straight from a combat vet's mouth, what the realities are. Tune in today at 1 o'clock on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.